A Thousand Splendid Sons by Khaled Hosseini.
This is the AR Podcast.
When school let out, Mammy again didn't show up like she was supposed to. Layla ended up walking home with two of her classmates, Giti and Hasina. Giti was a tightly wound, bony little girl who wore her hair in twin ponytails held by elastic bands. She was always scowling and walking with her books pressed to her chest like a shield. Hasina was 12, 3 years older than Layla and Giti, but had failed third grade once and fourth grade twice. What she lacked in smarts, Hasina made up for in mischief and a mouth that Giti said ran like a sewing machine. Today, Hasina was dispensing advice on how to fend off unattractive suitors. Foolproof method. Guaranteed to work. I give you my word. This is stupid. I'm too young to have a suitor, Giti said. You're not too young. Well, no one's come to ask for my hand. That's because you have a beard, my dear. Giti's hand shot up to her chin, and she looked with alarm to Layla, who smiled pityingly. Giti was the most humorless person Layla had ever met, and shook her head with reassurance. Anyway, you want to know what to do or not, ladies? Go ahead, Layla said. Beans, no less than 4 cans. On the evening, the toothless lizard comes to ask for your hand. But the timing, ladies, the timing is everything. You have to suppress the fireworks till it's time to serve him his tea. I'll remember that, Layla said. So will he. Layla could have said then that she didn't need this advice because Babby had no intention of giving her away anytime soon. Though Babby worked at Silo, Kabul's gigantic bread factory, he was a university-educated man. He'd been a high school teacher before communists fired him. This was shortly after the coup of 1978, about a year and a half before the Soviets had invaded. Babby had made it clear to Layla from a young age that the most important thing in his life, after her safety, was her schooling. I know you're still young, but I want you to understand and learn this now, he said. Marriage can wait. Education cannot. You're a very, very bright girl. Truly you are. You can be anything you want, Layla. I know this about you. And I also know that when this war is over, Afghanistan is going to need you as much as this man. Maybe even more. Because a society has no chance of success if its women are uneducated, Layla. No chance. No chance. Thank you. I regard the theater as the greatest of all art forms, the most immediate way in which a human being can share with another the sense of what it is to be a human being. Oscar Wilde. Hey everybody, last week I had a chance to sit down and really engage in a powerful conversation with two very interesting people. Stuart Dennison, a theater director and an actor, and his lovely wife, Azadeh Mirzayi, who is also involved in the same art form as an actor. They have performed individually and also as a couple, and being able to sit down and talk with them was an opportunity I couldn't pass.
Just kind of one of the most important things that I find about theater and what an actor should be doing is something needs to be at risk. Mm-hmm. And that something can be something very physical, it can be something very intense, you know, especially if you're looking at like a Shakespearean tragedy, you know, it's the throne or it's the crown or, you know, it's life and death in the drama. But also within much more subtle, sort of more like family dramas or something, if something's not at stake, then people won't buy it.
Yeah.
And that's why the actor either needs to go, yeah, possibly down the method route to really be in that character, so they're really experiencing it every night. Or, and I think more importantly in the modern world, the situation needs to be at risk.
I love process. I'm not like, when you're in a process, at some part of it, the most thing that you're looking at is the result.
Yeah.
But what we need a lot in Iran to work on is how to be in a process, how to collaborate in a process, what does teamwork means, how to put an organization together, and all the motivations, everything. And I think I love that. I love creating that atmosphere and being in that process. So for me, like always, like any project I do, the worst part is when it's like close to the ending, because I'm really not enjoying the endings.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, okay, the result is great, yeah, it's happening, there's mistakes, there are good things, but the process is over.
Yeah. This is the AR Podcast.
Thank you guys for the time.
Sure.
I told you guys, as I was coming here, my heart was pounding through my chest. I couldn't really believe that I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with you. You guys are pretty fascinating people. You might not know it, but you guys are pretty fascinating people.
Thank to you. Sit I'm down sure, and I mean, talk to. I'm not sure we're that fascinating, but hopefully we can be.
Yeah. One of the first questions I wanted to ask you guys was, how did you guys meet each other?
You want to take this or no?
No, go for it.
Go for it. Okay, so we met through the art form that we still spend our lives devoted to at the moment, which is through theatre, and we met in India, which is probably an unusual place for an Iranian and a British person to meet. But I was travelling there and working, and I was directing various plays throughout India. And as part of that, I went to Hyderabad and I sort of set up an open call for actors within a company. And through that, I got to know many people there, but one of whom was Azadeh. Yeah. And we worked together before we got together later. But we first met through that background.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I basically one day I was working with this Indian theatre company. So we got call, and we got a call from the director saying, so we have this British director who's coming to direct a play for us, and I want all the members to come for the audition.
Yeah.
So at that point in my mind, a British director was this really old, So yeah, I remember at a date when we went for the audition, there were 20 of us, 20, 25 of us went for the audition, and I saw him and I was like, oh my God, is this the English director? He's too young to be. But yeah, basically I auditioned for him and I got selected and we worked together on that play, and that's how we met.
Yeah. Did you select her because,
That's a question that we've been asked so many times. Yeah. No, I have some skills. I know a little bit about acting.
I mean, I'm very professional when it comes to my work.
So yeah, sure. Yeah.
I always tried to be. So no, it was very good. I mean, honestly, to that point, I'd had very little knowledge about Iran as a country.
Yeah.
Apart from kind of the historical aspect, you know, the historical culture, the ancient Persian Empire, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that side I knew, but modern Iran I had very little contact with. So I thought it was kind of fascinating for other reasons as well, for cultural reasons.
Yeah.
But no, at first we just worked together.
Yeah, it's kind of rare for us to have somebody as professional as you to come to our country and stay. Like, you know, we've had a lot of different people who've come to our country to understand maybe our culture a little bit, and then they've just left.
Yeah.
But you have stayed. Is there a, I mean, of course, it's mostly because of your wife.
We have a personal connection.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, honestly, mm-hmm. it's, if you'd asked me 10 years ago before we'd met, would I be living in Tehran in 10 years' time?
Yeah, right.
Working here on artistic projects and having this sort of lifestyle, I'd have said, no, you're crazy. How on earth would that happen?
Yeah.
It was never part of a long term plan. But what did happen was really fascinating on both a personal and professional level.
Yeah.
And I think having spent enough time here, I feel quite at home here. I feel, you know, both within the industry and on a personal level as well.
Okay, that's amazing.
And I think we lived in so many different places and countries and cities. Mm-hmm. So we have the experience of experiencing a new culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was not something new. So he was not just like leaving the UK, coming directly to Tehran and exploring the culture.
Yeah.
He loves exploring cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Iran is really fascinating, of course, culturally, especially because there's not much out there to the world for it.
And like, if there is, like, they're portraying it like, you know, maybe like something which is not true. And when other people when they come to this country, they kind of are like, you know, fascinated by the fact that like, wait a second, like Iran had this or Iran had that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, look at the culture. Oh my God, look at this and that. So like they might be even more fascinated when they come to and they live inside the culture.
I think the information out there, it's very limited about Iran.
Right.
Yeah, like many people know about the ancient Iran and the culture and the history.
And this is what we talk about most of the time. Like,
yeah,
as
but
Iranians.
About the 2 days life of the country and like what's going on, there's not much information out there. And this is what we really like to do. Like we like to, because there's a lot happening in this country, culturally, artistically, a lot happening. And it needs to be bridged. It needs to be understood. It needs to be shown to the world.
Yeah, I think honestly, people's expectations when they come to Iran. We see this with a lot of tourists, but it was true for me as well. Even with the personal connection I had before we came here, it was completely different to what I thought it would, to how I thought it would be in many different ways. You know, there are some things which exceeded my expectations. There are some things which were totally different and you know, just completely unexpected. But it is true. Like the view that people have of Iran outside is very partial. You know, there are some good sources, of course, but finding them is not always easy.
Right.
And you really have to kind of know where to look to get good information. But I think this is what we love doing. It's what's always fascinated me is I love being a foreigner. I think, you know, even before we met in India, where obviously I was a foreigner there too, I'd been living in different countries before that, I'd studied in different countries. And so for me, it was great. I love that attitude because it gives you a different perspective on the world, and especially when it matches up with my field, you know, with the arts and culture, because I think that's a brilliant way to understand others. You know, much better way than, for example, business. Business is good; it does many things, but when you're acting in the cultural field, it forces you to interact with real people and how they live and what they experience, what they go through.
Yeah.
And I think that's been part of, so Iran in this sense has been part of a much longer journey for me. One which is about discovering the world, self-discovery as well, of course, and trying to kind of figure out how this rather strange, complicated world in which we live fits together. How people from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds have various differences and various similarities, and how they understand those. And I think theatre, possibly more than at least most other art forms, allows you to do that, because it's about storytelling. It's about liveness, and it forces us to understand the daily routines of people, the things that make people happy, sad, their drives and their emotions, which I think is very helpful when we look at the challenges the world faces and a lot of cultural misunderstanding in our relatively globalized age. We these challenges need to be addressed, and arts and culture are definitely one of the best ways to do that.
Right.
But I think Iran is the, like, among all the places we have been, Iran is the only place we made a home.
Yeah.
Like, we were so good at just going to a place, get a house, live there for a while and pack and leave. Mm-hmm. Like, that was so easy for us. I remember, like, moving from Istanbul to Uganda, for example, was just like a decision of a week.
Yeah. Really?
Okay. Right. So I was just like, okay, I'm bored, I'm done. Okay, yeah, what should I do? Let's do some research. Okay, I'm going to go to Uganda.
Yeah.
And Iran is an interesting one, because it was the first time in our experience that one of us was a foreigner, one of us was a native.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which kind of changed the balance of that experience completely. When we moved to Turkey, we lived in Istanbul for a while, or when we moved to Africa, or indeed in India, we were both foreigners. So we both approached it with this kind of outsider view.
Right.
When we came to Iran, suddenly it was very one-sided, in different ways for both of us. But so I was experiencing something completely new, whereas Azadeh was coming back to something she'd known for a long time, but with me as someone to introduce to that culture. So it gave us a really interesting dialectic between us.
It made the role difference for the first time here, because like everywhere we had a term, for example, in India, of course, it's English, they call you foreigner. In Turkey, they call you yabancı, means like foreigner.
I see, okay.
In Africa, they call you like Muzungu, means like
foreigner again. That's
white person,
people.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I mean, it was a bit confusing for them, like when it was related to me, because like Stu was a Muzungu, a white person, but for me, they were not sure if I'm a Muzungu. So there was something between Muzungu and a Muhindi, which means Indian foreigner or white foreigner.
Oh my god, they have their specific words terms for each. Oh, that's amazing.
So, and I think this is always interesting to get that term.
Yeah.
It allows you to stay out of the culture and be an observer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in Iran, that's of course different. And I had this responsibility of, being an Iranian. I want to show my culture and country in a good way.
You have the hospitality vibe.
Just like, you doesn't matter how you live outside. As soon as you're back, you're the same Irani who wants to, be so hospitable and so nice. And so I was kind of his
tour guide
everything for a while.
Not just tour guide, like my guide through life.
Yeah, it was really nice in the beginning when he didn't know the language well enough to understand a lot of things. But when things got very limited when he's... Farsi got much better, so he got his own way of understanding the culture, so I had to back off a bit.
Yeah. But I think the role, what's interesting for me is like the role of the foreigner, outside of the personal level. Obviously there are the experiences that you have as a foreigner within any country, and hopefully, those extend beyond mere tourism for wherever you go. They're not just lining up in front of a monument, taking some photos and moving on. Hopefully there is more engagement, and I think that's a big issue in the world today. But when you do engage with this culture, I think there's a series of, at least for me, there's a series of responsibilities that come with that, which is they're not limited. They do extend quite far, but they do include things like making an effort to understand the culture, making an effort to fit in, making an effort to see those points of similarity and difference, and to debate them, to discuss them.
Yeah.
Especially in a place like Iran, where The number of foreigners here is it's growing, but it's still not huge compared to a lot of other places. I do see myself as a representative of for example, you know, British culture or European culture, even Western culture. Not in the sense of I need to impose that or bring it, but I'm able to discuss that with people.
Yeah.
You know, both on a personal level and in my work and through my interactions with people. You know, even with taxi drivers, you know, this is great. I get asked a lot, like, okay, what's England like? You know,
yeah.
And I realize that there's the information problem on both sides.
Yeah.
So I see that as a responsibility as well, and one that I hope I can fulfill in a good way. But it creates a different viewpoint as well, being a foreigner. So it does allow you to see things differently than either natives or indeed people from other countries who have never been here.
Yeah.
And so I think when the number of expats who live here for a long time is relatively small, it puts you in a fairly small group, which therefore magnifies that responsibility.
Okay, that's quite fascinating. As I mentioned, your Farsi is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come about to learn that? Yeah, because I was shocked. I was kind of surprised. I knew it based on the interview I told you guys that I'd seen. And I came in and I'm like, okay, fine. So I wanted to talk in English with you. And then all of a sudden you're like, you're talking in Farsi and it's fluent. And I'm like, what's going on?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, it's I feel comfortable in spoken Farsi, but my reading and writing is still some way to go. But I learned it through all these wonderful people who helped me, really.
My mom,
family, many of my colleagues in the various jobs I've done when I'm here, through people on the street, you know, shopkeepers, mm-hmm. honestly.
But very, I can say, like, one of the very first people who helped him to mm-hmm. learn Farsi and learn the base of the Farsi, so mm-hmm. he could then develop his Farsi based on that, was my nephew, who was at the
eight,
time, it was like seven.
Seven.
Oh, yeah, he was in the first grade. He was seven. Because, like,
you kind of saw yourself, like, you know.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You guys
they were studying
like
the same
other.
Books.
Yeah.
We both studied the first grade of Farsi together.
Together,
yeah.
He shared his books. And so I remember I would, like, do this dictation test that they both would write. It was
cute. I mean, it's good. And I think this is one of the things when it comes to language, is just about how who learns languages the best? Children. Of course they do. They learn it because they have no kind of shame. They have no sense of feeling, I must get it right, or I need to say it this way. They learn by saying things, repeating them, making mistakes and getting corrected. And
experimenting,
yeah. Exactly. So they're like little scientists who are experimenting with these new tools in front of them.
Yeah.
And that's the best attitude towards language that you can have, which makes you understand it and makes you able to use it.
Yeah.
So not just learning words from a book, not just listening and repeating without any understanding of how to use it, but learning it in a really engaged context. And fortunately, you know, and also because he was seven, he didn't try to speak to me in English, unlike everyone else. Even if their level of English wasn't great, they would maybe try and put English words in to help me understand, which is very nice and very considerate. But no, he just spoke Farsi to me.
Yeah.
So I had to understand him, or I had to at least try to, before we could make any progress. So that was really good. And I think if people generally approach language learning with that sort of attitude of just being completely unembarrassed by trying new things out, by experimenting, and then, you know, obviously getting feedback and correcting themselves, that's a much better way to learn than just saying.
That's the attitude. Like, this is exactly what I'm asking everybody to kind of focus on when they're learning a new language. That you guys need to just let it go. Like, if nobody's there to judge you, just like the 7-year-old who was talking to you in Farsi and really didn't really care how you, like, you know, replied back. This is exactly what any other language is all about. Like, you just need to let it go, relax, and talk, and basically convey the message. That's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. As we talked before, I really believe that, like, English is just the language of communication. So for me, like, I work with English. Yeah, it's important sometimes to speak English in a correct way.
Yeah.
But I've never been embarrassed by, like, my accent, my wrong pronunciation, or mistakes I made, because I just want, as you said, I just want to make myself understood.
Yeah. And when you have the self-confidence, people respect you more.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, you know, she knows what she's talking about. Because yeah. she has a level of self-confidence. As the, like, the memory that I told you guys. Like, that my American friend made a mistake in, like, grammar, but nobody really said anything about it. Because he was from America. And people were yeah. like, you know, he doesn't make any mistakes. Yeah. yeah. But they do, but they have... Yeah. all the self-confidence in the world. That
I think
just
there's
like...
a big deal here in Iran about the accent.
Exactly, yes.
Who speaks with British accent or American accent.
Exactly,
or
yeah.
your like so your accent can also like embarrass you and make you less confident about your speaking
yeah.
ability, mm-hmm. which is like not true, as I said. Like everywhere I lived, I just picked up mm-hmm. the
exactly.
accent.
Yeah.
And like... now if I talk to my Indian friends, my accent turns completely Indian. If I talk to my Turkish friends,
yeah.
I speak with my Turkish accent
yeah.
in Iran. It's like, it's a mix of things. And I'm actually so proud of it because
yeah.
it's the character of my language.
Exactly.
It's,
and
you
understand.
It's me.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I remember, like, I have an Italian friend and she speaks English with this really strong Italian accent.
Yeah.
Very strong. And I remember in Istanbul once, someone mentioned it to her that, you know, don't you want to like work a little bit on your accent? And her answer was like, I'm so proud of my accent.
Exactly.
This is me. This
yeah.
is who I am. What do you say?
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I think we should never be embarrassed about how we say it.
Yeah.
As long as we can make ourselves understood.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you're mispronouncing something, that's a technical thing. It's not to do with accent.
Yeah.
It's to do with probably, you know, either not putting the stress in the right place or you know, for example, just mispronouncing a vowel sound. Those things are technical issues. Those should be remedied, of course. But like, but yeah, do you want to speak like a British person or like an American person? Well,
mm.
why try either, honestly? It's not worth it. It's
exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
People are going to judge you based on that.
Yeah.
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 I always tell my Iranian friends when they ask about accent, I'm like, well, would it make any sense if I came to Iran and tried to speak Farsi with an Isfahani accent or a Shirazi accent?
Yeah.
Or it would be meaningless. It would be nonsensical. And they see that and go, okay, well, actually, that does make sense. Yeah,
it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But this is something that we don't really, because we are, again, we're low on self-confidence. And so we think if you're, our English is not 100%, it's not complete, you're not supposed to be
yeah.
talking.
Yeah.
But that's not true.
I mean,
yeah.
the best metaphor that I've come across to describe language learning, I think, is the difference between something like computer programming and playing a musical instrument.
Yeah.
Now, computer programming, you need every little bit to be in the right place before you can enter it or your code won't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you need to spend ages getting things exactly correct to produce an end product,
mm-hmm.
which is great for that field. But with music, you know, if you're going to learn guitar, for example, you could sit with a book and look at the frets and look at how you have to position your fingers for days.
Yeah.
And, okay, you might get a little bit of knowledge about what needs to happen next, but until your muscles adapt to moving between the frets and your hand knows how to strum at the right intensity and speed, which can only come from practice,
yeah.
until you've done that hundreds of times and made mistakes hundreds of times, can you begin to play songs? And so the same is true with language. You
yeah.
know, you need to just keep practicing, train the muscles, train your tongue, literally
mm-hmm.
your tongue and your mouth. To do that properly.
Yeah.
If you do that by making mistakes hundreds of times, you'll become good eventually. But by sitting and looking at a book, you'll only learn the theory,
yeah.
which is useful, but only a very small part
exactly.
of the whole thing.
One of the things that everybody asked me is that because my English was poor when I went to India, I didn't really know a lot of English. So they're like, you know, people come to me and ask me questions like, you know, how did you develop your English? And then I'm like, you know, it's something that when you're in the environment and you have to talk in English, that's something that it just gets built up, right?
Yeah.
So you kind of need to, like, you know, make that environment happen around you. Like if you don't really have somebody to talk to, find people that know just a little bit of English so you can actually like communicate with. And that's one of the only ways of just improving yourself in English.
Yeah,
yeah.
And of course, I think at the century we're living and the age we're living, it's like there are lots of other reasons to learn English.
Mm-hmm.
So like, as we discussed before, this is just like, you know, the devices we use, the data we get,
yes.
everything is just to some extent needs to know English enough to understand
exactly.
that, to use that.
Yeah.
And we're sort of forced to use all these devices, all these ways of getting data as information.
Yeah.
And I think it's just...
Like, one of the things is that, like, if people listen to podcasts more, mm-hmm. a little bit, like, because right now in Iran, we have a lot of people who listen to podcasts. And again, we have a lot of people who don't really know anything about podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to podcasts, like, every day, instead of listening to meaningless music on the way to work or something, like, I think that can have a very positive effect.
Sure.
On,
I think the advantage of a podcast compared to just listening to a English learning...
Like a tape?
Yeah. Is that there is a conversation that you need to follow. You need to, you know, to understand and, like, feel yourself at some point of it, agree with something, disagree with something. And I think this is what you need for a language, to be able to put yourself in that position, to be able to relate yourself to the topic.
Yeah.
And that's, podcasts are great for that, yeah.
For anyone living in Tehran, they're probably spending up to 2 hours a day in traffic anyway. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
If they listen to podcasts and listen to English language things every day, then within a month you'll have, you know, many hours of English, and without even really putting much effort in, you'll be learning. So which is great.
Okay, so thank you so much, because I always wanted to talk about somebody, like, you know, talk about this with somebody who knows, like, you know, English. Like as a native and as somebody who's like knows a lot of English, like, I really want to get your ideas out of this. So thank you so much. That's the first thing. How did you, Azadeh, how did you get into acting?
Okay, so I studied anthropology in Iran as my bachelor, but I was always like, I come from a family who are all artists.
Yeah.
My mom was a producer. My brothers, both of them, are into art. So I was kind of like the whole great family, the whole big family, were involved in this field, theater and film industry anyway. So I was not like far away from it. But I think like after I did, I mean, anthropology and sociology are also like something that I'm still very much interested in.
Even though I don't really know anything about it, but I am interested in it.
I think it's just
fascinating.
Any science that, like, help you to understand people more is great.
This is why I did architecture, because I kind of, like, knew if I did architecture, I had to understand people
exactly,
more.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And I think, like, after I finished my anthropology and learning a little bit about people and about cultures, I was more looking for a tool rather than more knowledge.
Yeah.
So I was looking for finding a tool to be able to use that education, use that data, use that what I've learned, make it practical, use it, transfer it, like bridge it.
Yeah.
And because of my background, my family background, of course, art was the closest thing came to my mind. And it came out actually the best one for me because, like, it's theater and it's drama. It's like, it's us, basically.
Yeah.
And that's how I decided to do my master in theater and acting, stage acting. And I went to India.
Yeah.
As you've been in India.
Yeah,
before.
Lovely country.
Yeah,
I love that country,
of course. It's my second home for sure. And that's where I did my master in theater there. And I think that's what I've been sort of doing since then. Using theater as a tool to educate people
to interact
exactly.
Yeah.
Like I was working with in Istanbul in Turkey, for example. I was working in a school, but I was as an English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I ended up like working with this hyperactive children,
yeah,
who were not able to communicate with the world, outside world. So what the only tools I could use there was the drama, theater.
Yeah.
So that was amazing, the effect of theater and drama to help this. And we had no common language. They wouldn't speak English, I wouldn't speak Turkish.
Yeah.
And I actually was there to teach them English. But then, you know, I was like, I needed something in the middle.
Yeah.
And drama was that bridge.
Yeah.
Or like in Africa, for example, in Uganda, we were working, volunteering in this village, and we were working in a school. And I remember the first week I was there. So it's like, it's Africa. It's like it's this area called Kiwangala in Uganda, and it's like basically they have nothing.
Yeah.
Like no water, no gas, electricity, nothing, absolutely nothing. And it's 12 villages with just one school, which is running by this NGO. So there are 800 kids.
Yeah.
And when I say school, don't imagine like a building with classes. It's just an open space that kids just come there. And the first week, I was there before Stu. I was there like 1 month before him. I arrived there. And I was so confused. I couldn't like... I mean, they would speak English to some extent because Uganda was colonized by Brits. We had a language, common language, but we had no cultural common understanding.
Yeah.
And I was so, so like shocked. I couldn't do anything. And I think the only like thing which helped me was... After 1 week of going to classes and being shocked and not being able to do anything with the kids, it's just like, okay, let's use music. Let's use drama. Let's use storytelling. And then suddenly a whole new window opened, a whole new door.
That's so fascinating.
And it was like, and look at it from the other side, not just from my side. Like the kids I was teaching, age of like, I had students from the age of 4, 5 to like 16, 17. And the very young ones were like really not, they would just come to school to escape the work they had to do at home. Like they had to wake up in the morning, early 5 o'clock in the morning, set up the fire, go to the farm, you know, do some work in the farm, then come back and walk like for maybe like up to 2 hours bare feet to get to the school. So they were really exhausted by the time they get to school.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to learn anything there. And then suddenly there is this new concept for them.
Yeah.
And they were fascinated. They were interested. They were just like quiet, trying to listen, trying to understand. This is what I love about theater. This is like, I think we need, there is a lot of data in the world. There's a lot of education, but the tool is what's missing.
Yeah.
And it's not missing, but it's what's not being worked a lot on. It's like we are... just educating ourselves a lot without finding ways of better ways of passing it to people who need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's in another way to sort of say the same thing is most people can relate to a great teacher they've had, you know, at school or at university potentially. And what made that teacher so good? Was it their knowledge? I mean, sure, that's part of it, but almost anyone who's going to be a teacher will have that level of knowledge.
Yeah.
What makes them a good teacher in many cases is essentially performance.
Yeah.
It's how they how they take that knowledge and present it in an engaging, active way.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously with the technical details being correct, of course, to the students.
Yeah.
And so that engagement, while some people see it as just education, is actually a form of performance. And this is something which I've seen in both my academic career and later in in my professional career is how much we perform on a day-to-day level.
Mm-hmm.
We're always performing. We're performing to others. And those people who are good communicators are essentially good performers.
Mm-hmm.
So the boundaries between someone being, for example, a stage actor and being a good friend or being a mentor or being a good teacher are perhaps less strong than we think. Than we think they are. They're in fact quite porous, and I think this is something which, when we understand the tools that something like theatre can give us, even at a completely amateur level, self confidence, expression, being able to talk to others, being able to empathise with others, this is very important too.
Mm-hmm.
These tools which the discipline of theatre can give you are actually really widely applicable. They're not just to stand up in front of someone and sing musical numbers on the West End stage or on Broadway. You know, that's fine, that's there, but actually these skills are very important individually, but also interculturally as well.
Yeah.
You know, so why is there so much problem between people from different backgrounds in the world? Honestly, a lot of it is because they don't understand each other.
Yeah.
And they don't understand each other's stories.
Yeah.
They don't understand each other's existences in meaningful ways. But yet, again, most people who are listening could probably think of an experience where they've seen a film from a different culture or a documentary from a different culture. And that in itself, by just giving a humanity to an individual, maybe fictional, maybe real, or a group of people, and seeing them in their real lives, struggling with real day-to-day challenges, having their own successes and failures, that creates a sense of connection or empathy, which is often missing from, for example, the news.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
The way in which we interact on a corporate or level internationally. And so, the world is becoming much more data-driven in many, many ways.
Yeah.
This could be a great tool for us, but it can also be quite dehumanizing as well. And this is something which I think that as we progress technologically, which is going to happen, this is already happening, we're progressing so, so fast, and I think there's huge opportunities for us in this field. We must remain aware of our individual and shared humanity as well.
Exactly.
And that the best tools for that are always going to be art and culture.
Yeah. I always say, I strongly believe it's really nice to say art for the sake of art, theater for the sake of theater, but what I believe is art for the sake of society.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that gives a total different meaning.
Yeah.
To the art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fine. So you went into acting as some sort of a necessity. You saw this because you said, I kind of had to interact with people, but maybe I couldn't do that with my language. So I had to kind of go into different fields of. So this was the beginning. So how did you continue this?
I think it's been the same and it's been developing, but it's always been the same concept in my mind, but mm-hmm. I've been doing it in different ways and different forms. For example, as I said, in Africa, I was like this. In Turkey, was like that. In India, I worked a lot with unprivileged kids.
Yeah.
And it was like you get the same result. It's really rewarding.
Yeah.
In Iran, moving in Iran, it was... the same thing, but you in each culture you have to find the right way of doing what you're doing. So in Iran, I think what I really think we need to do here, and what I'm really focused to do it, is international cultural management.
Uh-huh.
To try to bridge the datas, the worlds, the art worlds, the culture worlds together.
Yeah.
And especially in educational field. So this is what I'm doing now.
Yeah, okay. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
As somebody who's looking at this from another completely different perspective, this is what you're doing is amazing. So
yeah, I'm like, I can consider myself as a workaholic.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm really addicted to work and to what I'm doing. And I have no time limit. I mean, of course, I'm sure Stu is not happy about it. But
no, I mean, if you're doing what you love, it is good. And this sort of work, unlike, for example, other fields where you might say, okay, here's a project and it goes to this point and ends or whatever. I think both... Yeah, Azadeh and myself have the same attitude. It's more of a lifestyle that ends up getting channeled into projects, rather than, okay, what's my next project? And that's led us down some paths which I think we probably wouldn't have anticipated a few years back as well.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing, for example, which I notice we've done in Iran, which more than in other places, is taking it out of... specifically performance venues as well. So rather than just doing staged plays, which we've done a few of, but rather than just doing that, doing things like theatre for education, theatre for different groups of people, workshops, getting people involved in more participatory projects. And especially recently, as Ade said, doing this on an international level as well. So, it's taken us in different directions, which has been really interesting. I think it's helped us both, both personally and professionally as well, to kind of have to engage in different ways and have to develop different skill sets as well, rather than just becoming, okay, I'm a theatre director. That's what I do, and I do my very limited thing, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel that having experienced a wider range of things has really helped us both, actually.
Yeah, I think when you find the spectrum, then you're there are 1,000 roles that you can take and do to get what you want.
Is that something that's just pretty fascinating for somebody who's doing, because for me, as somebody, again, who's looking at this from another completely different perspective, when I see somebody who's an actor, I always think of, like, you know, you guys are so lucky because you get to live these lives that are, like, for me, I get to live somebody who's an architect and who is doing podcasts, yeah, but you guys can live any life, like, yeah. It depends on the role that is given to you. So is it, I think that must be really fascinating to somebody.
Definitely.
So somebody who's doing anthropology, like, I think that's just something, like,
it's, as you said, it's fascinating to be able to make someone's story yours.
Exactly.
And this is, like, I think the most important challenge about acting, which is, like, you have to live different personalities, and at the same time, to make yourself as close as possible to each character, you need to define it through yourself. You need to find points which are close to your own personality, and then develop those elements in yourself to get as to get close to that character. So yeah, it's really fascinating. It's really interesting, but it's not what just for me. It's not satisfying enough. So yeah, acting is great. I love acting.
Yeah,
but I don't consider myself as just an actress.
Yeah,
right. So professionally, also, I cannot tell that I'm an actor because I've acted in movies. I've acted in series. I've done several theater plays, both here in Iran and outside, but what I can consider myself professionally is more of, like, the developer, the manager, the cultural manager than the actor.
I understand that.
But
you
even...
You want to be known for that? Like, is that...
No, not really. No. I love process. I love process. I'm not, like... I mean, of course, it's as when you're in a process, at some part of it, the most thing that you're looking at is the result.
Yeah.
But what we need a lot in Iran to work on is how to be in a process, how to collaborate in a process, what does teamwork means, how to put an organization together, and all the motivations, everything. And I think I love that. I love creating that atmosphere and being in that process. So for me, like, always, like, any project I do, the worst part is when it's, like, close to the ending, because, like, I'm really not enjoying the endings.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, okay, the result is great. Yeah, it's happening. There's mistakes. There are good things, but the process is over.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love being in the process and, you know, developing a process, being part of a team.
Yeah.
And one thing I can say from the director's point of view is that, and this is having worked in, like, a lot of different countries, and I've seen this everywhere. There are two main types of people who want to be on stage.
Yeah.
And the majority of those people are people who want to be seen. They want to be, you know, they want to be in front of others. They want to sort of have people looking at them. And they can be very great. They can be great performers. There's nothing wrong with that. But normally it's an ego-driven experience for many of them. They love that sort of feeling of being applauded. And most of those actors are people who love the result. They love, you know, they'll stick with the rehearsal process, they'll go through it, but what they really feed off is that final moment of taking a bow on stage in front of everyone else. They feed on that. And then there is a smaller sector, but I believe who are the better actors generally, the ones who have longer careers and can do more with their bodies, with their voices, with their characters. And those are people who feel a responsibility to the character, or to telling the story, or to the process. Then those actors tend to be ones who are normally shyer individuals. They're not necessarily the really outgoing people who love being looked at, but who feel a deep connection to people and to stories and to feelings and to reality of emotions. And those actors, and I think, you know, when you look at film, you can see who those actors are, the ones who disappear into their roles completely. Those actors tend to be better actors in the long run. And exactly you said, many of them, the process of performing it every night is fine. They may enjoy that, and you know, getting applauded is all good, but they really enjoy the creation of character. They really enjoy being someone else, having that responsibility of telling a story. And and I think those people also therefore get the most out of theatre in terms of how they interact with other professionals and how they interact with their society at large. Mm-hmm. You know, they will do the background research. They'll go and live the role for a while. They'll find out as much.
Are we talking about method acting?
Method acting is a technique which many of these actors would use, uh-huh. but that could be used by both types of actors. Yeah. No, I'm talking about the much more deep psychological approach to acting. The reason for being on stage, the drive for wanting to act.
Yeah.
And that second group, who I'd say are far smaller in number, are often the ones who get the most out of it and give the most to the art form as well.
But at the same time, no one can ignore the joy that you get when you get applauded.
No, of course, yeah. That's there.
Of course,
but if that's the only thing you get from it,
it's wrong, basically.
It's every art form has its challenges and its own pitfalls, and this is one of them. You know?
But what I'm really trying to say is that, like, as an actress, I think there is a definition when, like, there should be like certain factors
mm-hmm.
that you have them, and then you can call yourself an actress.
Yeah.
In a professional mm-hmm. level. And yeah, we have a lot of actors in Iran who are like either studied or taking workshops or classes and all. But I personally, I don't consider myself, even with my acting background, I don't consider myself an actress because I'm not professionally that uh-huh. much involved. I think uh-huh. there's a definition for that, to call yourself a professional actress.
I see.
And I think this is very important, yeah. really important. I mean, like, yeah, everyone loves to be celebrity, famous, well-known and all. But you need to have certain criteria to, to call yourself a professional actress. I'm not a professional actress.
I see.
And it's not about skills. It's mm-hmm. not at all about skills. I mean, I don't talk about my own skills, but in general, it's not at all about skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's about what you do with that role in your life.
Right.
How much focus it takes from you and what you're earning from it. You know, I think that's a very important point about it.
And something, do you guys know Kobe Bryant?
Yeah.
He was a professional basketball player, and he said something which was I think is true in every sense, is that everybody, whoever sees professional people, like, you know, who are doing something professionally, they only see the result. Nobody thinks about the process. But what Kobe Bryant mentioned in his basically, it's like a love letter to basketball that mm-hmm. he published. And which won an Oscar for short movie, and it was that he keeps saying that what is important is the process. Everybody loves to be Cristiano Ronaldo, Leo Messi, but what they see is the result of the process. Nobody thinks about the fact that they've maybe trained so hard to become the players they are. So,
and no one thinks about how enjoyable can be the process.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone looks at the process as this time taking thing, time. But like the way I look at any process in my life, positive or negative, it's just like you can find joy in it. You can get satisfied. You can enjoy.
Yeah. Well, if anybody could look at life through your lens, I think that, like, yeah, because yeah, I think this is one of the reasons you're coming.
I think this is like an ideology. I'm telling you how much I'm like successful in what I'm saying. It's a different thing we can discuss. You know, I don't consider myself again like fully what I want. But yeah, this is like what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say that this is what I want to mm-hmm. do, and what I'm trying to do is help me with the word
to consolidate
put myself to the what's the word, not donate, devote myself to this ideology, to be in the process, enjoy the process, and help those who are around me to enjoy the process. I think whatever is that, is it like business, it's theater, it's teaching, it's
mm-hmm.
whatever it can be.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like I define it for myself a little bit differently than as I did, which is not that it's right or wrong, but for me, what I realized, actually, I didn't think this was how I approached it at first, but now I've come to realize that it is what's important for me is opening people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And because I believe very strongly in people having open minds and having the ability to experience different things, the ability to understand different people's perspectives, different ideas, and whether that's through a performed piece, which I would create for them in order to challenge or provoke various things, reactions or thoughts, or whether it's through the education, you know, in terms of, you know, like giving workshops and that sort of thing, or whether it's through practice or whether it's through process. What I really enjoy doing through the various things that I do is actually opening people's minds.
Yeah.
And being someone who can facilitate that, being someone who can guide and lead and challenge where appropriate. Yeah, challenge, push, whatever the technique is, that's kind of the payoff for me, the goal, the sort of the reason that I do it. And I find that when I end up not getting much out of a project is when I realize that hasn't been met, you know, and realizing that actually all that I did was fulfill a series of professional steps, which, you know, is fine. That's okay. People have to do that sometimes. Everyone has to you know, get involved in projects, especially in a collaborative art form, yeah, that maybe don't fulfill all of your dreams. But both on an individual and a work level, that's what I really enjoy doing.
So can you tell me something? Because for me, theater is something that I can touch.
Yeah.
Like, okay. For somebody who doesn't really, I haven't learned this academically. I have no idea, like, you know, sure, anything about it, like, in terms of studying.
Right, yeah, sure.
Like, sure. For somebody who doesn't really know a lot about theater and doesn't know a lot about cinema, when I go to see a play, I feel like I'm a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, like every now and then, I can just focus on a character, and I can just look at that character for like 30 minutes,
mm-hmm,
and nobody's gonna tell me, like, you know, you're not supposed to be looking at that. But when you're talking about a movie, you're looking at a character through the lens of the director is showing you that character, mm-hmm, the way he wants or she wants, sure, it.
Yeah.
So, like, theater for me, like, is something that I can touch.
Yeah, it's all about liveness.
Yeah,
that's the thing. If it's you know, for it to be theater or performance, there has to be a space at a specific time with a live interaction going on. And in that sense, as long as that's happening, you can call it theater. It could be mostly music. You know, it could be music. Like, so, I'd almost call a lot of more interactive stagey performances, like music performances, I'd call them kind of a form of theatre, a form of performance, you know. And yeah, that's not to say anything bad about film. Film is very much a director's art form, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, as you say, exactly about giving that particular viewpoint, which some directors do incredibly well.
Again, this is one of the reasons that I watch House of Cards,
right?
And in the series, like, every now and then, Kevin Spacey looks through the camera, like he looks at you, kind,
mm-hmm,
of like he looks at you and says something, and it's just like theater, like it involves,
right, yeah,
me into the
suddenly
play.
You're in there,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like it doesn't really have to be a sentence,
just a look
can,
yeah,
do everything.
Breaks,
yeah,
that
to break
forward,
that wall, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, this is why I love theater so much.
Yeah,
like, as somebody who, again, doesn't really know a lot about theater. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. I think that's why it's so powerful. Because otherwise, in almost every way, it's been superseded by other art forms.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to do realism, why do theatre? There's no point anymore.
Yeah.
Do film or TV,
yeah, yeah,
or whatever. It's much better for doing realism,
yeah,
than theatre is. If you want to kind of give a message to people, which, again, theatre used to be a great way for doing that. Like, nowadays, it just doesn't work. It's weak. It's a poor way of doing it. You should probably have a blog, or have a YouTube channel or something,
yeah,
you know. That's a far better way of reaching more people. But so theatre, the unique point about it is that liveness. You know?
Okay.
And that's where and anyone who's working in theatre in an intelligent way right now is or should be aware of that.
Yeah.
You know, okay, why is this art form, which is very old fashioned,
mm-hmm,
like very old, goes back to the Greeks, right? Why is this art form, which is incredibly old fashioned, why is it still around? Why,
yeah,
do we need it? Why do people care anymore? The only reason is because it gives them that liveness, that feeling of being in a room, being something happening right now, right here.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, you know, within Europe, but even within Iran, you know, you see this big movement against naturalistic theatre, against theatre with the fourth wall intact, you know, as if we're just watching life from out. So it's okay. It's a very interesting skill historically to look at how people did this, but
yeah,
it doesn't do very much anymore. So
do you find Iranians appreciative of the like theater, like,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah, like, especially right now. I mean, in the 4 years we've been here, I think there's been, like,
you know, as you could probably tell you more about before, but like suddenly in the 4 years that I've been here for, you, I can see a big shift in in both the level of theatre, the quality of it, and much more importantly than that, the audience.
Yeah.
And the audiences are packing the theatres. You go to see any of these plays that kind of gets a bit of a reputation, you can't get a ticket for it for the rest of the run. You know, it sells out so quickly.
Yeah.
And not only with star names. That's important. Yeah. If it's just people going to see star names, fine, then that's why it sells out. But that's there too. But even ones without stars are selling out, which is really good. And the number of new venues, the number of new theatre initiatives, the work you guys did with the festival last year, which was brilliant. You know, just bringing new things and new ideas, and people were so hungry for it.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
I think that's amazing. Like, that's the most advantage of, I would define it, the most advantage of Iranian theatre at the moment is the audience.
Yeah.
Because there is this huge society who are going to watch plays. You know? It's like, and they're from so many different backgrounds. So it's not just the intellectuals or the students. It is kind of becoming a destination for holidays, for like off times, weekends. It's a plan. It's coming to the people's routine schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And the journey for the past like 10 years in this thing, it's been great. It's been amazing. And I think, of course, we have to I look at it again through my own very like educational perspective.
Yeah.
Is that we have to also learn about the audience, about what they want and what they need, actually. So then we can also use theater as a better tool. I mean, I'm not criticizing anything. I'm just saying, like, if it would be great if we can use this tool to educate the audience, or to get what, you know, to let them express themselves,
yeah.
Let the audience also to have a role. So it's been happening. I think it needs more work. Better management, of course.
Yeah.
The relationship between audience and theater, the production.
Yeah. And I think it's the level of consistency as well. Like, our movie industry, I'm not saying anything, there's anything wrong with it, or there's anything, like, you know, I don't want to say anything negative about our movie industry. We're doing what we can with our limitations. This is what I believe in. But there's something is that our movie industry is not, for me, it feels like it's not moving forward. Like every year for me as an audience, I would just go into cinemas knowing, I think I said it to Ali Mustafa on the first episode of the podcast, that I know that I'm going to watch another movie which has got a lot of negativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to come out of the basically movie theater knowing that, hey, I think that just made my mood a little bit like worse like than it was. But in theater, like we see a huge like difference in the fact that you go into you go see a play, and the play is so professionally done. Even though there are no, you know, star names, like it, I don't know.
I mean, there are as well. I mean, that's
could be, yes, that, yes. Yeah. But for, like, the plays that I go for,
sure.
Maybe there are no like star names. But
mm-hmm.
still, they do it so professionally that I'm
mm-hmm.
like, why am I not going to theaters more? Why am I not going to see plays more? And every now and then we get a movie which is a great movie, and then we watch it, and we like, there's so many positive things about it. But
mm-hmm.
that doesn't really happen much. But with plays, we see that happen more often. Like the level of the play is so high that you're like, oh my god, like this is amazing. Like
mm-hmm.
I went for a play called Caligula. I think like that's
mm-hmm.
like I went to the play and I was blown away. Not like only by the performance. And of course it was the like I think I don't know who wrote the play. Like I'm pretty sure like it's somebody I forgot his name.
Caligula.
Tom Williams' play, right?
Which director?
I'm not sure,
okay.
But it was Salvador Abraham was playing. Like,
oh,
was
yeah,
Homayon.
Sure. So I'm like, I was blown away, and I was thinking at the time, like, I think I should forget about cinema for a while, Iranian cinema, and then I should shift to.
I think
theater.
It's just two different experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that theater can bring more excitement because of the liveness, as you said.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, I believe that as a theater audience, yeah, it's really great to have that excitement. But in a long term, when you become a theater audience,
theater goer, you
need to have some control over that excitement to be able to interact better with that with that theater, with that production. Yeah, of course. Like it's, I still, like after so many years of being related directly to this field, I go watch a play, which like makes me, you know, so excited.
Yeah.
And maybe it doesn't, like cinema maybe doesn't do that to me.
Yeah.
But I think I enjoy a play more, a theater play more, when I have more control over my excitement, so I can, you know, let myself go and be part of it, like my, let myself flow in that performance.
Yeah.
And I think what films are made to do, it's a totally different thing. But it's just like, for some reason, it just reminds me of this experience I had in India always.
Yeah.
That, to just define these two fields.
Yeah.
So I used to go to cinema a lot in India. I loved doing that, but not just not to go watch the Indian movies. I would always sit backward and watch the audience.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Because the the cinema audience in India are doing what the theater audience doing everywhere in the world.
I understand.
They don't care it's a movie. They get the liveness. They interact. They just get angry. They throw things. They just dance. Yeah. They get happy. So, like, I'd love that. I would just go sit backward, watch them getting their excitement.
Yeah.
So I think they're two different fields, and I don't think they're
comparable.
You cannot compare them together in what they're doing. And of course, like sometimes you get an experience from a theater. It happened to me that you get an experience that you don't want that.
Yeah.
You regret it.
Yeah.
Because it's so live, it affects you in a way that you're like, that was wrong for me. Mm-hmm. But cinema, of course, image keeps that wall. So you can always, it's much safer. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. It's much, much safer. A film, it's much safer than a theater performance.
Yeah. I mean, a theater should be dangerous to some degree. Like, I mean, I've always said, I mean, as you would tell you this before, from our work together, but like, as a director, it's just kind of one of the most important things that I find about theatre and what an actor should be doing is something needs to be at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that something can be something very physical. It can be something very intense, you know, especially if you're looking at like a Shakespearean tragedy, you know, it's the throne or it's the crown or, you know, it's life and death in the drama. But also within much more subtle sort of more like family dramas or something. If something's not at stake, then people won't buy it.
Yeah.
And that's why the actor either needs to go, possibly down the method route to really be in that character, so they're really experiencing it every night. Or, and I think more importantly in the modern world, the situation needs to be at risk, which can involve various different aspects. It could be involving improvisation. It could be involving some sort of free form.
Interaction.
It could be involving interaction. It could put the audience at risk in a sense, not physically, but in a sense that they don't know what's going to happen. And if you don't know what's going to happen and you're in the same room as someone doing something which is unpredictable, that's a dramatic situation.
Yeah.
You know, that's true in any place, not just in a theatre, but a theatre obviously codifies it and formalizes it, but imagine you're in a classroom and there's a student who disobeys the rules. That's dramatic, right? You know, what's going to happen here? What's the teacher going to do? Mm-hmm. What's the student going to do? Are they going to sit down and obey them, or are they going to have a fight, or are they going to be thrown out of the room? That's dramatic. You're interested in that. It's that scenario, or someone giving a speech who goes off topic, or goes off cue. You see a politician who throws their notes away. No, I'm going to speak from the heart. The journalists look up, oh my God, something's happening.
Exactly.
Right? Why? Because something's at risk.
Yeah.
And that's where drama comes from.
I kind of see a theatre as a little bit more experimental, in comparison to cinema.
It can be, and I think there's many reasons for that. But clearly financial ones are a huge issue. You know, you can take a risk on a play. And the costs involved in bringing it to the stage, especially if you're going to get a smaller venue or work with students, for example, or work with non-superstars, you can have that idea put it together, experiment as much as you want, and put it on stage for a relatively limited cost.
Yeah.
So you take that risk, and even if you lose money, you're not losing a ton of money. Mm-hmm. A film, of course, cannot do that.
Yeah.
Of course, I think the meaning of process again in cinema and theater is totally different.
Yeah.
So theater happens in the process.
Yeah.
But movie needs a very good pre-production.
Yeah, I'm kind of beginning to understand the concept. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly, that's one of the big reasons why we're in Hollywood, we're seeing this kind of complete split down the middle now, where we have massive blockbuster movies costing millions and millions, and we have small little arty films and nothing in between.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is a really big problem right now in Hollywood, because studios go, all right, we're going to lay out $500 million. We need a guaranteed box office return. What does that mean? It means the artistry kind of gets a very distant second to, is this going to be a success? Are people going to shell out money for this? And we need spectacular effects. We need big stars. We need explosions. That's all fine. But then the artistry, of course, gets so watered down by committee and by sort of the producers imposing their views and everyone having a different opinion and stars only being willing to be shown in a good light, for example, which is often in their contracts nowadays. So we end up with these very watered down blockbusters, which are lovely and spectacular, but have no real depth to them.
Yeah.
Or we end up with these much smaller budget, independent or studio films, which are done as prestige pictures to show, for example, how this studio or that studio is in fact very arty.
Yeah.
And they're done on a budget of less than 50 million, so like 10% of the budget of a blockbuster. And the studio knows they might lose money on them, but they'll make it back on the next Avengers movie or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's and again, neither of those are individually a problem, but the middle ground has been hollowed out of Hollywood, and that's a huge problem right now. Where are these big pictures which want to explore a theme which isn't necessarily super dramatic and full of explosions? It's not an action thriller. It's not a family comedy. It's something which actually has big themes and is interesting. But done on a big scale as well. And so I think we're really missing movies like that. You know, a lot of movies that, for example, Oscar would have won Oscars 10, 20 years ago are not being made nowadays because they don't fit into either of these nice categories.
Okay.
And theatre doesn't have that problem, thankfully. Yeah. So you can be a lot more experimental and live. And, of course, theatre can react much more quickly to current events as well. So
as a director, do you look into this? Like, you know, oh, my God, they didn't laugh at that or they didn't laugh at this. I might change some of the lines because of
you can. You can do. I mean, it's definitely, you know, different directors have different views, of course, but I'm a firm believer in the fact that, your play should, on the first night and on the last night, should not be the same.
Uh-huh.
Not that you should change it, but you'll naturally get different feedback.
Yeah.
You'll learn.
As an actor as well. Right?
Yeah, and if you're just doing the same thing every night as well, more than trying to build something new, that liveness is gone. That risk is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If every night you come out and do just robotically the same movements in the same way, deliver the line the same way, then, you know, again, nothing's at risk. So it'll seem flat to an audience, often without them realizing why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm sure you've had that experience when you've seen a theater play and you've been like, yeah, it seemed good. The forms were correct. The decor was lovely. But it didn't move me. It didn't touch me.
Yeah.
That could be because of bad acting. It could be because of bad script. It could be many reasons. But I think one of the key reasons that this happens is that sense of risk and liveness is gone.
Yeah.
So you see something which is very technically proficient, but kind of emotionally empty or risk-free. And that's what kills theatre, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so next time you're watching a theatre play, definitely that's something to look at. Like, does that actor... are they just waiting for the next line or not?
Uh-huh.
Are they just
it's very
going
important.
Through the
motions? Or when two of the actors are having a conversation, look at the one who doesn't have anything to do.
Uh-huh.
See if he or she is just sitting or standing waiting for their turn.
Yeah.
You're right. Again, that's the process.
Yeah, so as an actor, you need to find, I mean, like, true in that defined box by the director, depend on the director, but... you need also to find your way of being able to keep that liveness because, it's just like from the first night, it's new, second night still. But when you get to the 10th, to 11th, then, you know, you're kind of repeating the same thing. So you have to find yourself a way or ways to keep that liveness. I think audience are the best cue.
Yeah, right? You're right, yeah.
It's just like finding a way of understanding the mood of the audience of each night, depending on the play, of course. But audience bring their mood into the venue. And yeah. I can say as an actor that like before even you start the performance, the actors get the feeling, get the initial mm-hmm. mood of the audience. Exactly. Is it going to be a very excited audience or this is a very critical audience? Are they here to get entertained or mm-hmm. they're here to enjoy or they're just here to get something from the performance? So you get that feeling from the very beginning.
Before do you change, like as an actor, do you change your like ways maybe? Like if you
so it's very much depends on the director. Mm-hmm. So like, and the performance, like it, yeah. if it allows you to improvise, if it allows yeah. you to experiment, of course, I love that sort of performance that yeah. allows you to play around with the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. But yeah, most of the performances, like you have a specific script, line, cues, and you have to stick to it. But there are lots of ways still to improvise without changing your line,
yeah.
to improvise without changing someone's cue, to interact with someone's role. There are so many different ways, techniques and ways and feelings and momentary, like, actions that you can take without changing anything, uh-huh. but add something to the performance.
Right.
And I still always have this like problem with like, not problem, but like one of the things that really is important for him when he's directing a play is that everyone needs to be present.
Uh-huh.
I want you to be present. I want everyone to understand what's going on. I don't care if yeah. you're sitting back yeah. in the corner, you have nothing to do. Uh-huh. Just be in the present. Be understand what's going on.
Yeah.
No, I think this is something which, like coming back to Iranian theatre, this is something which is a big issue. I think there's a lot of very talented artists out there working in various fields. You know, directors, designers, writers. There's a lot of very good writers out there, and there's a huge amount of young people coming into the industry as well from the universities. I think there's a really good link between university and industry here. Mm-hmm. Which is not true in most other places, actually. Certainly not in Europe, certainly not in America. And these guys are providing lots of interesting fuel, lots of interesting ideas for the stage. One area which I think that there's still work to do is in harnessing that power and moving it forward together. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a collection of very talented individuals overlapping and clashing and hopefully sparks fly and we see something interesting happen. But that might happen one night and not the next, and then not the next, and then 5 nights later, everyone's wondering what happened and where it went wrong. What I do see a lot here is a lot of kind of emotional intensity, but without the repeatability,
yeah.
without being able to hit those emotions every night. And I think it's probably down to training, training and mindset. I think you know a lot of directors who I have spoken to here, I've seen their work. Still have a slightly, to me, old-fashioned notion of what the director is as being mm-hmm. a boss, you know, putting that yeah. person in there, says, do that, stand there, do that, mm-hmm. which I think creates very dead theatre, creates very sort of like stilted theatre. And then you often see an actor, despite that, still finding aliveness because they mm-hmm. feel it, they feel they need it on stage. So one thing I think would be really good for the future of Iranian theatre is to take these brilliant ideas and allow the other professionals to really work their magic, work together and offer more to it, yeah. rather than just coming in with a strict view and going, this is what I want from A to Z. We're going, okay, here's A, here's Z, here are some points we have to hit along the way. Let's find that together. Let's create a process, a mm-hmm. rehearsal process, a discovery process, which allows that to be more organic, more real in a lot of ways. And then I think that would take these very interesting forms that do exist and this very interesting kind of approach to theatre using different texts, using different ideas, and make it something which grows upon itself rather than, at the moment, I think it's a bit hit and miss sometimes. Yeah. You see some really great performances and you see some ones where the idea was perfect, but the execution was just was off for some reason. Yeah. And I look at that professionally and I can go, okay, it's not because the lights were wrong. It's not because the sound was wrong. It's not because the costumes were wrong. No, it's because you've got a bunch of people doing different jobs who haven't been synced up properly, who haven't been allowed the freedom to express themselves together. And so this is a more deep structural question for theatre in Iran at the moment. So that's one thing that needs to change. The second one, we touched on it briefly earlier, is about the venues and venue management. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some really good steps in this direction in the last few years. But the idea that a venue gives itself an identity, gives itself a kind of a feeling to it, not just the in terms of how it looks and how it feels, but the sort of work that people will see there. Mm-hmm. The sort of crowd that will go there. Do they want intellectually challenging plays? Do they want experimental ones? Do they want physical theatre? Do they want theatre which is going to be dealing with the classics in modern ways, for example? And there are a few venues of the multiple that have sprung up who are starting to define themselves in that way. And I think that's the key to sustainability. That's the key to kind of finding a way to turn a venue from being a place you go to see a play into a destination itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something which I think, again, is moving forward, but bigger strides need to be taken.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the relationship between a venue and the audience of that venue, of course, it's a both-sided relationship. And as much as the audience needs to have, you know, effect on the type of performances, you know,
yeah,
which is going to happen in that venue, it should be the opposite as well. You know, of course, like to attract audience, to attract people to start a new entertainment, mm-hmm, called theater, you need to start with the things or ideas or forms that, you know, it's not yet very complicated for them, so they can relate to it.
Yeah,
it's popular.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning, you know, and then you can move on. You now you have your audience. Now you can, I would say, train your audience, yeah, to enjoy different type of performances. Like, yeah, you can, you may start with a comedy in a venue. You can keep having comedy shows and you can, of course, keep having your audience coming, enjoying. But the most important thing is that you've got an audience.
Yeah.
That means the beginning, not the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that means now you have to work with your audience, train your audience, study your audience, observe your audience, talk to your audience. Like, for example, one thing which is very missing here is data bank.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important. Like, as a venue, as a company, as a group, whatever, when you have some audience, you need to know them.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know who they are. As a gallery, even, as any organization, art organization, you need to know who are the people who are regularly coming there. And knowing them is not just having their names and their emails.
Yeah.
You need to know what their background is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Mrs. A has joined these two types of performance, but not that type.
Mm-hmm.
Why? How can I bring Mrs. A to that,
yeah,
performance? These are the game, and this is the process that I've been talking about.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I cannot say unfortunately, but hopefully I can say this is going to happen,
yeah,
that the venues can work better with their audience, understand their audience better.
Yeah. Okay, guys, thank you so much. I just want to sit down and talk to you, like, I told you, for days, and, like, you know, I'd love to do that. But I understand that you have a limit on time. And I had so many other questions that I'm pretty sure you guys know of, but we don't really have the time for that right now. So thank you so much for the time. And as a challenge, would you like to challenge somebody else to be on my podcast to talk in English?
To challenge them?
Yeah.
it's a pleasure. It's not a challenge. But no, I mean, thank you very much. It's been really, really good. And yeah, I'm sure we'll have to talk again in future.
I would love to do that. Like, I think this is part one. I hope this is part one, because I have so many questions that I would love to talk to you.
Welcome to the 10-hour long podcast. I've listened to the first couple of episodes of your podcast, and I think it's great. I think things are definitely moving forward, and this is really good, and I hope the listeners agree and give their feedback and give their ratings as well.
Yeah. Sure.
But I think there's a lot of people from different fields who I think have a lot of interesting things to say about
about art and culture in Iran right now. It is a fascinating moment to be here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of change within our own field and in other fields. And I do think that this is a great way for Iran to connect with others, and hopefully, you know, make people a bit more curious about what's going on here and give them a bit more information and knowledge about it. I'd like to see, or to hear rather, things from different fields, from literature, from film, from photography, and just hear these different viewpoints. So rather than a specific challenge, it should be a general challenge, I think, to people who would like to express themselves in English and hopefully rise to that challenge and give you and the listeners some good material.
Sure, I think I totally agree with you. Thank you, of course. Thank you. It was really a nice chat, and I think I hope that we can at some point continue. Yeah, there's a lot of things to say.
Yeah,
and I'm a very talkative person as well.
Which is amazing. please, like,
So yeah, thank you so much, and I also agree with Stu about. It's more about the topics and how much you can explore with the topics. What I really want to hear is, I think it's just like more of, how do I put it? Like maybe technological aspect of like art.
I
would like to hear a point of view of someone technical in the art, not just the artist.
Yeah.
Because this is what I'm feeling missed in my like my gatherings, my work. Yeah, there's a lot of artists. We're all artists. But the technology of the art, I think, the technology of managing the art, and this is what like I need to hear about. Maybe I need to learn about.
Yeah, it's developing so fast. And I think there's so much more that's going to happen here, which is brilliant. So yeah, hopefully we can hear more of that in future.
Yeah, sure. Thank you guys so much. Yeah, that's all I can say. Thank you so much. Thanks. And I hope we can meet each other more and we can talk more.
Yeah.
And thank you. Thank you.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can only hope that I can do another podcast with them soon. I have so many questions left. Anyways, thank you all for tuning into the podcast. And thank you for your amazing emails. This always provides the much needed momentum. Thank you. And never forget that you have the ability to surprise yourself. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in.